Tonight on Arena, Black Bear, I Blame Society and Sisters with Transistors are the movies up for review. And we talk to Adrian Duncan about his new story collection, Midfield Dynamo. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. To movie reviews first this evening and on the slate this Thursday night, the feminist slasher flick, I Blame Society, which asks whether it's possible to make a commercially successful film with a likeable female lead who also happens to be a serial killer. The documentary, Sisters with Transistors, explores the unwritten history of the pioneering women in electronic music. But first, we look at Black Bear, a meta-psychodrama slash comedy from Lawrence Michael Levine, starring indie darlings du jour Christopher Abbott and Sarah Gadden, joined this evening by Daryl Jones and Tara Brady, who've been to the virtual cinema for us. Let's start with Black Bear for us, Tara. Playing a lot of tricks on us, this film, I think it's safe to say. Give us the setup as we start watching this.
Well, I'll give it a go. It starts out and we have Alison, who's played by Aubrey Plaza, and she's looking over a lake, and she's sitting by a cabin somewhere in upstate New York, and she takes out a notebook, and see, we're not really sure if everything that comes afterwards is some kind of fiction, but what does come afterwards in tone falls somewhere between Mulholland Drive by David Lynch and Fawlty Towers. We have an opening section that's called The Bear on the Road, and we never really told what the bear means, but we do get a bear. A Plaza character is an actor turned director. She has retreated to this remote guest house to await for something meaningful to happen to me, as she puts it. She's looking for inspiration. And what follows is certainly meaningful, although it will make you squirm. The house belongs to Gabe, who's played by Christopher Abbott, who's this sort of failed musician, and his heavily pregnant partner, Blair, played by Sarah Gadden. As the wears on, they drink too much, and the couple start remarks about each other, and the situation gets more and more embarrassing, and it's exacerbated by more alcohol and by Gabe's apparent interest in Alison, and by all kinds of bad choices made by
All right. Let's listen to a clip, actually, which picks up on the alcohol-filled conversations and, in fact, row that you're talking about in that opening section of the film. A row about feminism from Black Bear. Christopher Abbott and Sarah Gadden in this clip. And I should warn you, particularly towards the end of this clip, there's very graphic, very strong language, and some of you may find it offensive.
You know, it's like for hundreds and hundreds of years, the nuclear family meant everything to people. Right? Everybody had their defined role. Now, that's broken down. There's no real sense of family or community anymore.
Communities that viewed women as private property.
Well, yeah, and from our modern perspective, that may seem terrible.
No, it's objectively terrible.
Objectively? I'm 6'1". That's an objective fact.
Are you following this?
Okay, how can we know women weren't happier prior to the Industrial Revolution?
They definitely were not.
Fine. All I'm saying is that the erosion of traditional communities is part of why things are so chaotic right now.
Oh, and that's why everything's so chaotic.
Look, I'm not saying that feminism is bad. All I'm saying is that all these things have disappeared. You know, religious beliefs, for example. You know, delusional or not, their disappearance has created an absence in the meaning of our lives. That's why all these things that you don't like, nationalism, fundamentalism, white supremacy is on the rise, right? Globalism, feminism, those things are—
What's your point, Gabe?
I'm saying that nature is just gonna fucking do what it do, you know? And the fucking earth is gonna be consumed by the sun.
Fuck.
And all this shit like ideology, religion, consumerism, you know, it's all just a bunch of bullshit that people created to distract ourselves from the idea that we live in a fucking horrible shithole.
Yes.
It's a big shithole, meaningless fuckhole.
How is it helpful to think that way, Gabe?
I'm not trying to be helpful, Blair. I'm just trying to tell you the way it is.
And that's it. Christopher Abbott as Gabe, Sarah Gadden as Blair, and you heard a bit of laughing and clapping along there from Aubrey Plaza as Alison in the background. Are you okay, Daryl, having listened to that clip? Because I know Tara mentioned about squirming as we watched this. I think you were doing a little bit more than squirming, were you?
I certainly was. I've come to the conclusion that the black bear is a symbol, and it's a symbol for my own hostility towards this film. My goodness me, I found this film unbearably stressful to watch. So the first scene that we've heard there, it's about 45 minutes long, and it gets worse and worse. It reminded me of a kind of millennial Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Mm-hmm. You know, where we are is in the world's worst dinner party, watching a couple degenerate from, you know, what starts off as bickering with these passive aggressive non sequiturs to a full-blown fight. And, you know, there were various points where I was watching it behind my fingers. Once or twice I had to pause the film and walk around the room to regain my composure. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, I do not want to watch self-absorbed millennials fighting. And it turned out that you know, the entire first scene was like this. And with hindsight, it was my favourite part of the film.
Yeah, because... Very different experience, Tara, I think, from the one you had watching this film. When we get into the second part of the film, again, suddenly we see the Aubrey Plaza character sitting at the table again, writing something, and we go off into another section, which is called Bear by the Boathouse. And this is the making of a film. Same characters are there again, slightly changed. The dynamic is slightly changed. Where does it bring us to in that second part of the film, Tara?
Well, again, there's a lot more cringe. You see, it's very interesting, like the second setup, because we do have swapped characters, and we don't want to say too much.
Mm, yeah.
It's going to be a spot, but like the way that's done is very clever, even down to like we subtly swapped clothes and things like that. And we end up with this scene where it's some kind of, you know, fictionalized version again of the people we saw in the first thing, but there is still more embarrassment to come. And I think there's been an awful lot of talk, I suppose, in the last decade or so about cringe comedy in America. And that would be like shows, I suppose, like The Office and also in the UK as well. But shows that occasionally present you with dilemmas that make you want to watch between your fingers, as Daryl had it. But I'm quite good with that experience, I think, because I think and I think this film treads a really interesting line where people are at their most dramatic and most serious is sometimes when they're at their most right. ludicrous. And that's really mm-hmm. what the film is going for. It's mining comedy from that. And I think it's a very interesting companion piece with another film that Aubrey Plaza directed and stars in, which you also need to watch largely behind your fingers, which is Ingrid Goes West, in which she plays someone who stalks this Instagram star.
Right.
And it's absolutely excruciating to watch, but it's absolutely fascinatingly excruciating as well.
I'm not sure at what point you took the two Sulpidine that you mentioned in the notes that you sent in, Daryl. I think it might have been just at the very end of the film, but I presume you were walking around the room at some point during this second part of the film. But you can't deny the quality of the performances here, surely. Particularly for me, I thought Aubrey Plaza playing this actress, if you like, in the second part of the film, who we see her making the film, we see her switching from mad drunkenness to this performance on set. You're not sure, is it performance or is it not performance? Is it the character herself? Is it Alison? I mean, did none of that tickle your fancy?
No, it did not. Look, there are things to admire about the film. Yes, the performances are very good. As a matter of fact, by all three leads, I thought it's at times beautifully shot. There's this recurring scene of Alison sitting on the jetty in this very striking red swimming costume and looking out to the lake, and the whole thing looks great. The people in it look great, but I even now, even speaking about it is causing my blood pressure to rise.
Yeah, so but no is basically your end judgment. How is it going to manage in the stars rating from you, Daryl?
Well, look, I mean, this is not an insult to the universe like Cats or Mrs. Brown's Boys, but rarely have I enjoyed a film less. So I suppose two stars.
Two. Tara Brady, you were watching a different film. I incidentally was watching a different film from both of you. I was somewhere in the middle in this. Where were you, Tara?
I'm 4.5 easily. I really liked it. I think it is a lot to say, and it's provocative, and I'm good with provocative.
Okay. So 2 and 4.5. Good difference of opinion there to get the ball rolling this evening. Let's move on. The film, by the way, called Black Bear. Let's move on then to Sisters with Transistors, electronic music's unsung heroines, Lisa Rovner's documentary. This really aims to expand our knowledge of women in electronic music beyond Delia Derbyshire, which most people will have heard of her in and around the Doctor Who theme, Tara. But this really gives us the full-on history of women in electronic music and a very important role played by women in electronic music. There might be very little electronic music without them, in fact, it would seem.
Yeah, it puts together a series of little vignettes rather than, you know, going for some kind of big overarching narrative to introduce us to these different composers and artists, and it has various questions at its core. One of which is asked by one of the experimental musicians that features in the film, Pauline Oliveras, who asked in a New York Times essay in 1970, why have there been no great women composers? And, you know, part of the answer to that is given by Laurie Spiegel, who's another one of the artists in this film, and who actually is an electronic composer who features on the Golden Record, which, as we know, are the two golden discs that accompanied the Voyager probes out into space. And one of her compositions went along with Glenn Gould playing Bach. And she makes the point that, you know, we women were especially drawn to electronic music, you know, partly because electronics allowed them to make music that could be heard by others without having to, you know, get past the kind of gatekeepers and the establishment and that sort of thing. So the irony of this film is that it builds itself as an untold story, and for most of the women it is an untold story, because electronica may have been a refuge for these women, but still the big names when you come to think about electronic music are people like Jean-Michel, they're all males, but that doesn't mean that these women didn't produce like incredible work. And I think there's really kind of wonderful vignettes about Neil Oram, who was one of the founders of BBC's Radiophonic Workshop ahead of Delia Derbyshire coming in and composing the Doctor Who theme. And then we get Laurie Anderson, of course, as narrator.
Let's listen to a clip that features Laurie Anderson. You also mentioned Laurie Spiegel there, one of the composers featured in the film. And in the clip we're about to hear, Laurie Anderson narrates. But before we hear what they're saying, there is a footage of two ravers in a field after an all-night party, and they're addressed by a reporter.
Are you guys going to stop ever, or are you going to keep dancing forever?
I'm keep dancing forever, I mean. Well, at least till I remember where I put my car.
This is the story of women who hear music in their heads, of radical sounds, where there was once silence, of dreams enabled by technology.
Technology is a tremendous liberator. It blows up power structures. Women are naturally drawn to electronic music. You didn't have to be accepted by any of the male-dominated resources, the radio stations, the record companies, the concert hall venues, the funding organizations. You could make something with electronics, and you can present music directly to your audience. And that gives you tremendous freedom. But somehow women get forgotten from the history.
Laurie Spiegel there, and Laurie Anderson, also the narrative voice that we heard in that clip from Sisters with Transistors. The feminist ideology really is very much at the heart of this story that's been told here, Daryl. What is that part of the story that we get?
Yeah, so this is a very serious work of feminist artistic history, I think. Pauline Oliveros, who Tara's already quoted, also asks another question, which is, how do you exorcise the canon of classical music of misogyny? And the film shows various ways in which these remarkable women composers and musicians do this. Oliveros herself, you know, has an explicit explicit and very radical feminist ideology. For others, the politics are more implicit, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. The film's point is that electronic music has provided a form of feminist resistance to artistic and gender hierarchies and orthodoxies, and we get a number of the composers talking about the low to mid level sexism that they encountered at various points. Eliane Radigue, the French composer, records that in her early days in the 1960s, the male technicians only tolerated her in the studio because they thought she smelled nice.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary moment, that
it really is. Yeah.
And Pauline Oliveros as well asks at one point, because they were often referred to at this at points along the way as lady composers. And she, Pauline Oliveros asks, why am I not just a composer, please? Could we start with that, take that as a starting point? But one of the things that I thought was really interesting here, Tara, is the way in which film, for starters, is associated with this type of music, but for the musical establishment, they wouldn't even refer to it as music. They refer to it as tonality or sonic effects, but they just wouldn't use the word music.
Yeah, no, there's a definite sense of them being outsiders, but there's also a kind of sense of them plowing on regardless and plowing on with really interesting work that is slightly, you know, outside of the mainstream, and being happy to be outside the mainstream. Think, like, you know, if you've got any interest in sound, like the work of Marianne Amacher, who's like a former student of Karlheinz Stockhausen and an installation artist, you know, she's composed using sounds generated inside the ear that are only audible to the hearer. I mean, that's just incredibly fascinating. And then you get Rodrigue, who Daryl just mentioned, like, was one of the first sound engineers to incorporate tape feedback into her compositions, and has gone on to create this huge epic Buddhist cycle, which got some sponsorship from the French government. So they've found their place regardless of whether they've been accepted by the establishment, and it's a very good place to be.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful sequence at the beginning with a woman called Clara Rockmore playing the theremin. And she was a really well-known violinist, and she plays the core classical repertoire on the theremin. It's absolutely beautiful just to watch, apart from anything else. But is this film, Daryl, is it really just for those who are sonically awoken, sonically woke, if I can put it that way?
I would hope not. Look, I mean, I think you do need a taste for the avant-garde really to appreciate and enjoy this film. So this is a film, about women composing 75-minute atonal drones and things like that. But I think, you know, as an example of women's history and women's artistic history, and just as an example or as a series of remarkable artistic creative people, it's riveting, I thought.
Stars from you, Daryl?
Oh, 4.5.
4.5. What are you saying on this one, Tara?
Oh, 4.5 as well.
Accord. Harmony. Yay. On film number two. Electronic harmony on film number two. And that is Sisters with Transistors. I also love the title of that film. Let's move on then to I Blame Society. Director Gillian Wallace-Horvat here. Actor, director and writer of the film, plays a struggling filmmaker who resorts to extreme measures in her latest screen project. In some ways, I saw huge similarities, Daryl, between this film, I Blame Society, and the first one we spoke about, in that there's a big meta story going on here as well.
Oh, yeah, very much. I mean, the two films speak to each other quite clearly, I think, and in some ways also speak to Sisters with Transistors quite clearly as well. But, you know, watching I Blame Society, I thought, oh, now we're talking. Thank goodness for this.
No Salpadine for this one, no?
Oh, no. On the contrary. You know, I mean, this is, I think this is a film that delivered for me on all levels. You know, Gillian herself, who is a struggling filmmaker, and is thwarted at various points by men she's having relationships with, men she wants to get jobs from. She's turned down and rejected, but discovers that in reviving an old project, a documentary exploring whether she'd be any good at murder, that she's really, really good at murder. But much to her frustration, her greatest advantage is that nobody will believe, in the same way that nobody will believe that a woman can make good films, it seems, no one will believe that a woman can be a brutal and effective serial killer.
Let's listen to the character of Gillian then, played by Gillian Wallace-Horvath, confronting her boyfriend Keith for not supporting her choice. And Keith is played by Keith Polson.
Oh my God. Is this because of what I said about my MO? Keith, I can't believe you think I'd ever want to hurt you. That's crazy. If there was something wrong, I would just tell you. I did all this because I finally did something, you know, accomplished something today. And I wanted to celebrate with you.
That's good, baby.
That's a little underwhelming. You're acting like you don't believe me.
I don't know, it's just, you know, a lot's been going on lately, and I don't really know what we're talking about right now.
What we're talking about is you don't think I can do anything. You don't think I'll ever make a movie. You don't think I could kill somebody. You don't believe I can do anything. And it really hurts because I believe in you. I believe you can do your elevated sci-fi David Lynch graphic novel. I really do. Why can't you believe in me?
And there we go, Gillian Wallace-Horvath and Keith Polson in a scene from I Blame Society. Daryl had the Salpadine out for film number one. This is a very self-referential film, very aware of what it's doing itself. Did it wear on you in any way, Tara, or am I the only one of these three who was a bit worn down by this film?
Oh, no, it didn't wear on me at all. I mean, it's cheap as chips. It's obviously not like it's done on an absolute micro budget. That's Gillian Wallace-Horvath's own apartment. That's her own cat. Mm. That's really her mother and her grandmother, and her mother hilariously when she goes, "Do you think I'd be a good murderer?" Oh, like, you know, being, "Oh, well, you could be anything you want to be."
Yeah.
That's really what her mother said. And there are parallels, I suppose, with the cult Belgian film from the 90s, Man Bites Dog, in which a film crew start killing people in order to make their documentary more interesting. But this film doesn't take itself at all seriously. It's very, very lighthearted. You know, even the sort of blood splattering is all very cartoonish. Mm. And she's very good fun and very good company throughout. She's a very, very interesting filmmaker and has a really great sense of humor about herself and everything else.
And to be fair, she does make a reasonable film with, as you say, two and fourpence, I would say, was at the height of the budget on this one. A lot of hipsters around the place, though, Daryl.
That's right. A lot of them getting horribly dispatched. In part, you know, there is a politics to this film, as I've suggested. You know, she's a kind of righteous avenger, and she kills some horrible people. Sexists and lecherous older men, and you know, awful, horrendous film producers, but also, best of all, a kind of whiny healthcare provider. There's a moment where she's eavesdropping on a conversation with this whiny guy boring a woman at a date, and turns to the camera and says, "He has to die." And, you know, I think everyone is nodding their heads at that point.
I'll have to give it a second go, clearly. Stars from you first time on this one, Tara?
Four
from you. So you enjoyed it enormously. And what are you saying, Daryl?
Oh, 4.5. I laughed all the way through.
4.5. You laughed all the way through. Black Bear, I Blame Society, and Sisters with Transistors are three films this evening. Just before we finish up, Tara, the Oscars on Sunday, just the best picture. What are you heading or nodding towards?
Well, the favourite is Nomadland. It's won the SAG. It's won the BAFTAs. So that would certainly be the bookies' favourite. However, with the Oscars, we have preferred voting. So I would not rule out a Moonlight style surprise this year. It's just going to be a question of which way will that fall. It could go with Minari, which is like, you know, kind of safe family drama and has consensus choice all written all over it, or it could be that the Oscars, you know, given that they have done so much work about in diversity in recent years, and trying to make their academy look more like society does, that it could be that they want to make a big statement and that they'll go with Judas and the Black Messiah or Promising Young Woman. And then again, Nomadland would also tick
fit
the
that,
box.
Yeah, it would.
Yes.
It would for sure. Well, listen, we shall find everything out on Sunday evening into Monday morning, I'm guessing. Thanks very much for that. And as I said, our three films, I Blame Society, Sisters with Transistors and Black Bear, with Tara Brady, Daryl Jones speaking to us about the scene. Bay City Rollers singer Les McKeown has died at the age of 65. The Scottish vocalist was the front man of Bay City Rollers during their 1970s heyday. A statement from his family on Twitter said, "It is with profound sadness that we announce the death of our beloved husband and father, Leslie Richard McKeown. Leslie died suddenly at home on Tuesday, the 20th of April, 2021. Formed at the end of the 1960s, the Bay City Rollers enjoyed huge success at home and abroad from the mid-1970s with their distinctive tartan outfits and tunes like Bye Bye Baby and Shang-a-Lang. They had a massive teen following, sold more than 100 million records. The group were regular visits to Ireland where they played venues like the Savoy in Cork, and indeed Les McKeown played a sold-out show in Dublin's Olympia at the end of 2019. So we will remember Les McKeown with this. Bye bye baby, don't make me. Yes, particular poignancy to those lyrics now as the news comes through today of the death of Bay City Roller singer Les McKeown. He died on Tuesday and he was 65. Midfield Dynamo is Adrian Duncan's third book, but his first collection of short stories. His debut novel, Love Notes from a German Building Site, won the inaugural John McGahern Book Prize in 2019. His second book, A Sabbatical in Leipzig, was very recently shortlisted for the Kerry Group Novel of the Year in 2021, that is, and he has also been shortlisted for the Emerging Writer Award at the inaugural 2020 Dalkey Literary Awards. Midfield Dynamo is a collection of 12 stories, pick at themes of construction and engineering, family and memory, but there's a very strong absurdist style to the fore across all 12 stories, I would argue. I'm delighted that Adrian Duncan joins me now on the line. We have to start out with the formation, the team formation, as you put it. You might explain, you give us a little line in your note to the reader at the beginning and on a diagram on the very next page, how you've arranged these set of stories, Adrian.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show, Sean. But the stories basically came out of me being unable to visualise the book by thinking of the stories in a vertical list. So basically, whenever you're kind of, you know, if you're trying to do a mixtape or if you're trying to organize any kind of series of things that you're interested in, and if you do them in a list, it's kind of a useful way of putting them together. But I just couldn't decide on which story should come before or after the next. It just, I couldn't settle on which one should be first, second, third, fourth. I just couldn't work it out. So it hit me about, I think it was about this time last year, actually. I just woke up in bed one morning and I said, I know what I'll do. I'll turn it into a football team. So 11 of the stories are told kind of in the first person. So I decided that that would be the 11, sort of the 11 players. And then there's one story called About the Weight of a Bucket of Salt, and that's told in the third person. So I decided that would be on the sideline. So what I did was I started to arrange it out into a 4-4-2 formation. So that would be four defenders, four in midfield, two up front, and a goalkeeper. And I started thinking about the sort of personalities that someone might have to play in these different positions. I played football when I was younger, and I could definitely intuit that a centre half
has a very generally had a slightly different personality to, say, someone on the left wing or the right wing, or someone up front would have a slightly different personality to someone playing left back or something like that. So when I put out the team formation, I started to sort of intuit a personality off each story. And then it started becoming very, very clear to me which stories would suit which position. So let's say, for instance, Half Bird, Half Bear, which plays left wing, I knew instantly that would be that story would not play well at centre half or would not play well in midfield. So it became very, very natural and very it came to me very, very quickly. And then
it sounds to me, Adrian, as if you were missing football so much on the television and so much without without fans in the stadia, because probably at the point you were making this formation for yourself, there was practically no football happening anywhere, was there?
It could have been a gigantic longing of that kind, for sure. what was really interesting was, as I kind of went through it, then I started kind of thinking back to when I used to play, and I started thinking about different kind of patterns of play that they might have. Mm. And when I was doing this, I read John McGarren's book, The Leave Taking, last summer. Or should I say, I reread it. And in the sort of note at the start of the book, he says that a novel kind of has to stand on its own, but a collection of short stories, the stories can kind of lean against each other in a certain way.
And
I thought in this 4-4-2 formation, I could see the direction in which the stories could lean on each other, essentially. So it just helped visualize.
Yeah. And also, I mentioned engineering, and you were an engineer. You studied engineering initially. Love Notes from a German Building Site has engineering and the construction industry all over it. Sabbatical in Leipzig, similarly, we spoke about the engineering aspects in that. And certainly engineering comes up again here. But I want to start with what I might think is this the safe pair of hands then of the collection? The opening story, number one, design number 108, the goalkeeper of the piece, kind of doesn't know. He gets the ball and then he starts and he kicks it out a different way every time. You might explain how the goalkeeper's personality fits into this initial story.
That's a very, very good way of putting it. So that story, I wrote that about maybe, I think it was about 10 years ago I wrote that. And it was one of those, for me, stories come out either very painfully, like they don't come together for years, or they come out quite quickly and they kind of come together quite quickly. And this was one of those that came together fairly quickly. So at this time, I was studying two things. I was studying Russian short story writing. So I was doing a creative writing course up at the Irish Writers' Centre. And one of the tutors, a guy called Greg Baxter, he introduced us to Russian short story writers. And one of these Russian short story writers was a guy called Danilo Karms. And part of his style is to do this repetitive telling of stories that alter slightly as they continue. And I just found this extremely alluring and absurd and interesting. But also at this time, I was studying the Bungalow Bliss book, the Catalogue of House Designs, that came out actually 50 years this summer.
Yeah.
And this is this is a really important book because it's basically the spine of where most rural housing through the 70s and 80s and 90s in Ireland came from. So I was essentially studying these two worlds at the same time. And I decided to sort of bring them together in that story, design number 108.
So what we get is essentially the opening paragraph. We get kind of five different versions of the story, if you like, within one. The opening paragraph is exactly the same. Yourself, or when we were very young, my brother and I used to stand in the front window of our sitting room and peer out to the world. Our house, I should say, is pure bungalow bliss, straight from the book, design number 108, The Hazels. And then something different happens every time after that. But quite definitely a taste of the absurd in there. Do you think it's very obvious, particularly in that early story and in the earlier stories, does that kind of filter out in some ways, or does it just become a more subtle type of absurdity as the book moves on, would you say, as the stories move on?
Again, that's a really good way of talking about it, because part of one of the sort of patterns through the book, and this is what I would have talked with my editor, Sean Farrell, from the Liverpool Press, was that as the stories sort of seem to move from west to east, the absurdity or the style of absurdity goes from east to west. So as the stories kind of move away from Ireland, the style of writing becomes a little bit more traditionally, say, Western, let's
yes.
say. So there's a kind of a crisscross happening in the book in terms of style and content. So yeah, exactly what you described is sort of happening over the course of the book as well.
Okay, I'll chance another analogy since I'm on a roll. Then I'll stick with the football one here and the game of two halves. It's a book of two halves, isn't it? In that half the stories really are from way back, and half the stories in the second part of the book, for the most part, I think, are new stories, very recently written. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, that's correct. And because personally, I've moved from Ireland over towards Central Europe to Berlin. Mm. So that kind of that shift in location is sort of a natural drift that occurs in the book as well.
And as you're saying, that shift in location, yes, but ironically, maybe the style more harking back to Ireland when you're over there as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. There's a sort of I would say a homesickness sort of coming out in the style of the writing or something like that.
Tell us a little bit about the title story itself. I enjoyed this one in particular, Midfield Dynamo, because this deals with memory and family and the way stories are told in lots of ways.
Yeah. So Midfield Dynamo, I wrote that maybe about 2 or 3 weeks. It was one of the stories that came out easily. I wrote it a couple of weeks before I kind of left Ireland in the first instance. And I was just basically walking around Dublin with my notebook and my pen. And I just started writing out single pieces, just single short pieces. And they just came in bursts. I don't really plan my stories at all. And none of these bursts are planned. They're just kind of, well, what should I do next, you know? So I worked away in them for about maybe... for that afternoon, and then I put them down. I felt there was a good energy in them, you know. And then after 6 months, I sent them to Brendan Barrington at the Dublin Review, and he loved them, and he said, yeah, I'd love to take this story. So then when usually Brendan at that stage, when I was learning my craft, he would have to bring an awful lot of editorial suggestions to the work. But with this one, he didn't seem to need to bring too much to me, and the story came out quite easily. In terms of what it's doing, do you know, I was talking to Cathy Sweeney recently about this story, and I don't really understand this story, but it's actually one of my favourite ones that I've ever written.
Well, tell us what's in the body of the story, if you like, so that the listener can follow why we both like it so much.
Yeah, so the story essentially is kind of telling the reader about his father. And things that his father has done, and things that his father has done, but also things that there's no way this narrator could know that his father has done. Mm. So it goes through things that would happen to the father, let's say, in a small town in the centre of Ireland. So learning how to dance and then teaching others how to dance is one story. Meeting a girl in a library and going for a kiss and cuddle with her down in a smashed up car is another story. Another story harks back from sort of deep into my own family's past, the Duncans, and we used to have a cinema in Ballymann. And part of what they used to do was to bring cinema reels out to the smaller townslands around Ballymann and show films there as well. And I had heard stories about this when I was younger, and these sort of things then filtered into the Dynamo as well.
And interesting that the Dynamo, I suppose, is a thing of creation. And there we go, all of those creative impulses within what you're telling us. It can't be a mistake that a fella from Ballymahon, from the Midlands of the country, in a story has two fellas, one called Foster and the other called Alan. You couldn't tell me that's an accident, are you?
No, absolutely not. No. That's one of the jokes that I don't expect many people to get, but that, well, if they do get it, I'm really, really pleased. Yeah. There's all of these sort of country and western references going through the book, and there's references to like the Bog of Allen as well, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's for sure happening.
It'd be interesting to see the PhD thesis from an Eastern European student around Foster and Allen, in fact, and how they fit into your work. Dreams, I think it's safe to say, too, play a part in a couple of stories. And incidentally, engineering is within that story with the Foster and Allen boy characters in it. But dreams, I wanted to talk about just as we finish up, Adrian. Oregon Grape Tree, dreams involved there, half bird, half bear, where you're talking about sleepwalking as well. Are dreams any part of your creative process? Do they feed into it in any, your dreams feed into what you write in any way?
Yeah, I would say that certainly with these short stories, an awful lot of them come from when I wake up in the morning. So when I come out of that sort of weird sleep space, when you're kind of, you don't know if you're dreaming or not, and you wake up to a sort of ache, or I wake up sometimes to an ache to want to go back to the dream. So sometimes an awful lot of these stories come from that energy of like something pops into your head that you wouldn't think of during the day. And that comes from the very back of your head somewhere else. And then that's what I pursue often in the stories, is just this strange thing that appears in my head first thing in the morning. So dreams are very, very important in terms of, you know, the energy of the work as well as everything else. Yeah.
Well, listen, great to speak with you, Adrian, and the mansion of Ballymahon. I have to say thank you for the lovely article you wrote in the Irish Times recently. You were remembering back to a play I was involved with. Frank Pig Says Hello brought back some great memories. You saw it in Ballymahon. You must have been very young at the time.
I was. Thank you very much, Noel. And I really enjoyed writing it. And I was about 13 or 14 when I saw it. And it was a mind-boggling experience for me. And I loved it. And I can still remember it very, very clearly. Yeah. And it was really wonderful. So thank you for that.
Not at all. And I see Patrick McCabe on the front of the book. Make no mistake about it, Adrian Duncan is an artist of the highest order, is a quote from Patrick McCabe. On the front of the book, Midfield Dynamo by Adrian Duncan. Nice to speak with you about that this evening, Adrian. Thanks for that. And Adrian's short story collection is called Midfield Dynamo. It's published by the Lilliput Press. The Dog Eat Dog World in Shadow and Bone, the new 8-part fantasy series beginning tomorrow evening on Netflix. It is set in a fictional country, a place called Ravka, a place divided by warring factions and a mysterious deadly border known as the Fold. Alina Starkov, played by Jessie May Lee, is our heroine in this case, a young orphaned map maker whose looks make her stand out dangerously from the crowd and whose cartography skills are by no means her only gift. These then are the tales of the Grishaverse, based on the internationally best-selling novels by the US author Leigh Bardugo. Jen Gannon has been watching it for us. We'll talk to her shortly. But first of all, let's hear from the character of Alina Starkov, as played by Jessie May Lee.
I learned about my true enemy when I was a child.
Is it real?
Of course it's real. The Fold ate your parents. It's the reason for many of the orphans here. People trying to cross, taunting the saints.
Then why cross it? Why not go around?
Read the map. The north want our Grisha dead. The south guards its mountains. We have nowhere else to go. Now work on your shading, girl. Keep a pencil in your hand, or else someone will put a rifle in it instead.
I spent years thinking I'd find a way out, around the Fold, to go somewhere where no one cares where I'm from. But now, I'm old enough to know the only way out is through.
Jessie May Lee in a scene there from Shadow and Bone, the new Netflix series. Jen Gannon has been watching this for us. Yep. Well, you know, we've all heard the dog ate my homework as an excuse, but never before had I heard the Fold ate your parents.
The Fold. We're all lost in the Fold at some degree. Yeah,
we need to know what the Fold is, I guess, to understand the basic concept behind this big Grishaverse, I suppose I should call
it. Yeah, it's a big, you know, border, basically. It's like the, you know, Stygian fog. It's an ethereal partition, basically, of black smoke. It's almost like, if you've seen the Alex Garland film Annihilation, it's kind of like the Shimmer. It's like a mystical force field, and it's inhabited by these monsters called the Volcra. And passing through it, you're dicing with death. But everyone wants to dominate or ultimately destroy the Fold to unite the country of Ravka once again. So you got to get in the mix of the Folds to get into Shadow and Bone.
And Ravka has all sorts of people in it, with squallers, trackers, heart renders, Volcras, as you mentioned, they're not people. Are we in a basic good versus bad type of thing here, where everybody has a specific role and we just, you know, these roles are created purely as types rather than real flesh and blood characters?
Well, you know, pretty much. I mean, it's a mix. Like, so you do have, there's a nod to all sorts of fantasy favourites in this. You've got, you know, Harry Potter right down to Alina, who is our hero. She has a scar on her forehead. There's a touch of Lord of the Rings in the landscape of it. And there's definitely this element of the Hunger Games, or for me, Captain Planet, because the Grisha, who are these magical outsiders, they're all split into factions. So you have some Grisha that control elements like wind and fire, then ones that control the body that can either harm you or heal you, and then some are able to work wonders with solid matter. They can move through buildings and invent them even. So, I mean, it's a lot of detail. It's, you know, with these fantasy things, it's about world building. So there's a lot of lore and language and geography to get stuck into. And if you enjoy that very specific world building, there's tons to immerse yourself in here. It's not as intricate, though, as it could be. And you won't get that, you know, headache that's very off-putting where you wish there was some kind of glossary or subtitles. It's pretty easy to get lost into this world for any fantasy novice. I kind of use a direct comparison that for anyone not used to the, you know, acronyms and line of duty, you just have to concentrate very hard.
And can you place it in time? Because it struck me watching it. I just watched the first episode today. You could be in a post-apocalyptic world in some ways, or you could be in some part of an alternative history, but there's a technological aspect to it which is kind of contemporary as well.
There is. I mean, one half of it where Alina kind of resides, which is, it's very much Russian based. They all wear the kind of Russian style hats and frock coats, which I'm obsessed with. There's some beautiful costume in it. But like that kind of half of the world looks like the first morning at Glastonbury, where you wake up and the steam is rising and it's kind of muddy out. And then there's another half of the world where this criminal gang known as the Crow, they live on this seedy island off Ravka. And the easiest way for me to explain that is, if you're a Star Wars fan, it's like the Mos Eisley of Ravka. That's where they live. It's this underworld. So they kind of live in this steampunk Dickensian Cockney world, which, and those two worlds nearly don't combine until very late on in the series. So they're kept very separate, those storylines. So sometimes it feels like the Crow underworld are pulling you away from the main story of Alina, and you always want to try and get back to that. But yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of different looks to it, and it does look very beautiful. You know that they have spent a lot of money on this, and it's all up on the screen. I mean, technologically, like, the effects are pretty stunning, like, especially something when you get into the force field itself, like within the fold, it is a spectacle. What, like, those fantasy epics have to be to attract your attention.
And is there a bit of a love story running all through this?
There is a bit of a love story. There's a love triangle. So she has like a Twilight style love triangle. First of all, she has her old friend Mal, who is a fellow orphan, and he's part of the First Army with her. So her, you know, sentiments lie with him as a childhood friend. But then there's also this new man that comes into her life and whisks her away because she learns that she has these magical powers and that she is a Grisha too. And that he takes the place of, it's Ben Barnes, who we know from he was in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I think, as well, and he's General Kerrigan, and he's very mysterious and moody. So Alina is in the middle of this, and she has to kind of, which she's trying to sort out within herself, what way that she wants to go. Does she want to follow the magic of the Grisha, or her own cartography and her work, or does she want to, you know, and those men, two men, represent either side of her. So it's your usual kind of young adult teen drama.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the books on which it's based are young adult books.
Yeah, they are. And it's really on that side of things. It's not your dark incest and dragons of Game of Thrones. It's very much tipping into, you know, young people's television. It reminded me kind of there's the BBC version of Merlin, which was, you know, a pretty tepid enough take on that epic. And I feel that Shadow and Bone is moving into that direction. So there are scenes of violence. For younger viewers, I wouldn't really encourage them to watch it. But like for your early teens, I think it's pretty much safe to watch.
Yeah, I suppose The Hunger Games would be the best guideline in terms of what age group you might be saying it's fine for them to watch. You wouldn't put anybody who's not a teenager, certainly you wouldn't put them in front of this.
No. There is pretty much, like, there's scenes of graphic violence definitely in it that would be far too terrifying for very young kids. So yeah, it's definitely, I think they're trying to corner the teen market with this for sure.
And in particular, the look of it now, I found bits of it quite dark and you know, kind of squinting at the screen to kind of get a look of it. But perhaps it needs, does it need a big screen treatment, this, even though it is made for telly?
I feel like that a lot of critics have been complaining that they were very much lost with it, because it is dark based. And I think that's just literally because she is a light force, and later on, as you see her using her powers, it becomes like there's elements to it that become brighter. But yeah, you do kind of have to go through a lot of the darkness to get to the light, to be heavy metaphorically there.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think the more you see it, the more you get used to it, the more it reveals itself, as in it actually does look pretty spectacular.
And Alina and Mal, the two childhood friends, there's clearly there, we're on the side of light and good there.
Exactly.
There are several contenders for villains in this. There's about three or four of them in the first episode. Any of them could turn out to be terribly, terribly villainous for the entire thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It is one of those, because of those fantasy epics, it's trying to pull a lot of elements together. And there's six books of this, and it's eight episodes for this one season. So we'll see if the success, if they move on to seasons, you know, the rest of the seasons, because we have something like, Netflix have been up and down with their fantasy fare, and they had something like The Witcher with Henry Cavill, which was a surprise hit for them. It kind of has this campy style into it that people really enjoyed. But something like this is more serious, so you do wonder how difficult it will be to streamline these breeze block size novels into manageable chunks for the screen.
Will you stick with the eight episodes for this first season at any rate, Jen?
I know for a fact that Zoe Wanamaker makes a really good appearance in one of the later episodes, and apparently she steals the show, so I really just want to see that for one. So I'll probably stick with it just to see what happens with her. But pretty much it's one of those very rote stories that a lot of people have seen before. You're not reinventing the wheel here. It's your typical outsider story battling against the world. So, I mean, if that sounds compelling enough to you, then fair enough. For me, there's too much smoke and mirrors and not enough depth for my liking.
All right, that's Jen Gannon on Shadow and Bone, begins tomorrow evening on Netflix. That's our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy Research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gareth Duffy was on sound. This evening, tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.